Well, good morning. We are wrapping up our series called Recovering Life. 2 weeks ago, we had Dr. Dave Simbora here talking about healing from our brokenness and depression and anxiety. And last week, we had David Timms come and talk about stress and anxiety. So this week, we thought we'd lighten it up a little bit and talk about healing from the wounds of our past. For the two of you in the room who had perfect lives, you can just, you know, tuck this sermon away because you live in a world of brokenness and you're surrounded by people for whom this is a very real topic. So we're going to be talking about how we heal and what that looks like. A few months back in May, my oldest daughter graduated from college, and we were going to be giving a big graduation party. And so you know what happens when you have a big event like that at your house? You clean, right? All the things you haven't dealt with for so long, you decide, now's the day, I got to deal with those things. So it was Saturday, the party was on Sunday, it was a big work day, everybody had their jobs to do. And my two younger daughters, I gave them, their job was fill up Jesse's truck with everything that needs to go to the Goodwill, the dump. Oh, and by the way, there's this 10-gallon paint container that we're never going to use the paint from, and I found a store just a couple blocks away. They recycle it. Take that there. Okay, break. Let's go. So they leave, and I'm getting ready to do stuff, and no sooner, like 3 minutes later, my phone rings, and I'm like, hey, Mom. I go, oh, Lord, what happened? And she's like, the paint spilled. And I go, what do you mean the paint spilled? And she goes, the paint spilled everywhere. It's all over me. It's all over Jesse. It's all over the truck. And Mom, it's like all over the parking lot. And so I said, can you drive away? She's like, no, Mom, it's behind us. We opened the bag and it fell out. And I was like, ah, gee. So she goes, you need to bring as many towels as you can. So I go and grab as many towels as I can from our house. And there's this wonderful and terrible thing that happens in our family, and that is we get the giggles, but sometimes it's at the worst possible time. So I'm putting all the towels in the car, and I just start laughing, like uncontrollably. And it only takes 3 minutes to get there, and I'm like, okay, Heidi, this is not a good time. You need to stop laughing. And I get out of the car, and I'm like trying to contain myself, and I get the towels, and our eyes meet. They see, and I start giggling, and they're like, because, you know, the guys at the paint store, They weren't really laughing. So I take all the towels over there, you know, and within like 2 seconds, all of our towels are totally used up, and there's still like gallons of paint that they're trying to deal with. And my girls are literally like covered in paint. We had to throw their clothes away and everything. So I'm standing there for a few minutes trying not to tell these young men at the paint store what to do, but apparently they don't have a protocol for this kind of thing because I guess it doesn't happen very much. So I go, you know, I wonder if I go get a shovel and a pail over at the 99 cent store and we just start like shoveling the paint in. And he goes, oh, that's a good idea. So I run to the 99 cent store. I get a couple of plastic shovels, a couple of pails. That works for a while, a long while, because we're scooping up lots of paint. And then we get to the place where I think we need more towels. So I run to the 99 cent store and buy towels, come back. We use all those up. I run to the 99 cent store, buy more towels, come back, use all those up. And then we've got it all where, you know, there's a mound of gross towels and everything else, but it's looking pretty good. And I said, you know what? I think if you just turn on the hose and wash it down, I think we're going to be good. And he goes, yeah, we don't have a hose. I go, okay, I'll go to the 99 cent store and I'll buy water. So I go to the 99 cent store and I'm buying these big gallons of water, you know, and I went through the express lane every time. And so as I go through the line, the kid brings up the first one, he sets it down and he goes, are you okay? Which made me have the giggles again. It was too long of a story to tell him, so I was like, yeah. So then we, you know, get the water all over. And finally, almost 3 hours later, the paint spill is cleaned up. And as we're getting ready to go, you know, we're all just a disaster. The guy at the paint store goes, you know, next time we'll come pick it up at your house. The point of that really ridiculous story is that we all have containers of old junk shoved in the corner of our lives somewhere that need to be dealt with. Because if we don't deal with them, they spill out and make a humongous mess and cost lots of people. So today, we're going to be talking about what it takes to heal from the pain of living in this broken world. And it really begs the very first question, is healing possible? And I believe from the scriptures and from life experience that it is. At the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he'd been baptized by his cousin. He'd gone into the wilderness and been tempted. And then he's standing up in the temple, which was his role to do as a member of the community. And he was handed a scroll. And on the scroll, of course, it just happened to open to a passage in Isaiah, a prophetic book. And it says this. Jesus stands up in the temple and says, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." At the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he stands up and he says, "I am all about the healing of this people." He claims to bring good news, liberty, recovery, and freedom. And so I'm wondering, anybody here today who's in need of some really good news? Anybody feeling captive to something you just can't quite get over? Anybody feeling oppressed by the pressures and burdens of life? Anybody needing more freedom? Anybody suffering from a lack of vision? Well, guess what? You're on Jesus' radar. You're on his mission. Because that's why he came. Jesus came to bring the kingdom of God to earth and to restore what had been lost. The characteristics of his kingdom are peace and hope and joy and reconciliation. And these things, they're reflective of healing. These are things he wants us to experience now, not just in that awesome future that he has planned for us. The point for Jesus is abundant life. Life overflowing, full life. But abundant life has far less to do with our external world than it does our internal one. He wants us to experience his kingdom and then be a part of expanding that kingdom of peace, hope, joy, and reconciliation while he is restoring all things. But let's be honest. Life here can be brutal. People die. Spouses cheat, marriages dissolve, friends betray, children are victimized. It's a harsh world, and sometimes healing feels so far away. But Jesus is the wonderful counselor whose priority is our redemption and restoration. You see, it's not a perk for Jesus if you experience healing. It's a priority. It's not a perk for Jesus if you experience healing. It's a priority. So today I want us to focus on three things that impact our experiencing the healing that Jesus has to offer. There are a lot more things we could say than just these three, but we have to focus in the time that we have. And the first is we must engage the process. You know, healing is not magic. We all would prefer God just take out his magic wand and boom, we're healed, like Hermione, you know, in Harry Potter just says, "Obliviate." And all of your painful memories are just gone. They've just vanished. We want to pray a prayer and poof, we're healed. And while God is perfectly capable of that kind of intervention, because nothing is too hard for him, he typically walks us through the valley, through the process, because he has different miracles there. He has more in store for us. Because he wants to reveal himself to us while he heals us, not just give us relief. If we look at the story of God over the span of time, we can see that he has been working out his redemptive plan from the very beginning. From the fall of man, to the children of Israel going to the promised land, to the coming of Christ, to this present age that we're in now, God works over the arc of eternity, and he is in the process of restoring all things. Because God is a God of process. We're saved, and then he spends a lifetime sanctifying us, teaching us, making us more into the image of his Son. Think of Peter. Right? Jesus looks at him and says, you're the rock on which I'm going to build my church. But at the moment that he said that to Peter, Peter was a crushed, defeated, ashamed, broken ball of clay. And Jesus looks at him and says, yeah, but we're in a process, buddy. I'm going to heal you. I'm going to grow you. And you're going to become a rock of a leader that my church will endure on. Philippians 1:6 is one of my favorite verses. It brings me a lot of comfort in life because it says this, for I am confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will complete it until the day of Christ Jesus. Do you hear how process-oriented that is? God began something and he's going to complete it until the day of Christ Jesus. Healing takes time, but time alone does not heal. Time with Jesus, however, does. It requires that we open up those deep, painful places in our life to him and let the light of his grace expose them, cleanse them, and love on them. We got to take those containers of pain and bring them to Jesus and say, here's all the junk. Here it is. In Psalm 51, it says, you delight in truth in the inward parts, and you teach me wisdom in the secret places. If we invite Jesus' truth into those deep inward parts of us, he will teach us truth and wisdom in those secret places. That means he will move, he will heal, he will redeem those places. But if we don't, if we choose to keep that container of paint shoved away in a corner, then our history will determine our future. Because things that we don't process from, we don't heal from. Things that we don't process, we don't heal from. And often the very thing that allowed you to survive whatever it was, whatever that painful thing was, the very thing that allowed you to survive that coping mechanism, when it's used as a strategy for living, it undoes you. It destroys you. It hurts you. It was meant to cope during that time of crisis and stress, but when we don't process, we use it as a strategy for living. So, for example, a child who's abused, sexually abused, disassociates, disconnects from her body. So the abuse is happening to her body, not her, and she goes somewhere else. Some other fantasy world that she creates. But she doesn't process that abuse. And when she becomes a mother and her kids are approaching the age she was when she was abused, guess what she does? When she gets overwhelmed, when she gets stressed, she doesn't stay in reality. She goes somewhere else. And they're saying, Mommy, and Mommy's somewhere else. That disconnecting helped her survive. And now it's undoing everything she loves. A little boy who had to be perfect growing up so as not to be the trigger of his father's intense rage turns into a workaholic who is riddled with anxiety because he never, ever feels good enough. Someone who suffered a traumatic event relives that event over and over and over in their mind. But externally, they maintain high levels of control on everything and everyone to try to manage the chaos. If we don't process, we don't heal. And instead, we do things like compartmentalize, we isolate, or we make sure that we are never alone. The thing that helped us survive is now crippling us. You see, the patterns that we experienced for good or evil, some of the patterns we experienced are really good. The patterns we experience for good or evil have more power in our lives than we often realize. Let me demonstrate it this way. So my youngest daughter is an athlete, and she went to Friends Christian School here, and there was this award called Iron Woman. And to be Iron, I know, sounds pretty awesome, right? No cape or anything, but Iron Woman. So she wants to be Iron Woman, and that means you have to make a varsity team for every sport. You have to make a varsity team. So she's trying out for softball. Never played softball before, but she's trying out for softball. She makes the team. I, on the other hand, I grew up on the baseball field. My dad was a baseball coach from the time, I don't think I was ever alive when my dad wasn't a baseball coach. He was a baseball coach from my birth all the way until I was a senior in high school. So I spent a huge majority of my life on the baseball field watching my dad do things like this. You know, giving signs, saying weird things to his players. You know, it was just a part of my childhood. It's what we did. So Jessie gets up to bat for her first time against, of course, the fastest pitcher in the league. Really? So first pitch, swing and a miss. It's okay, baby. You're going to get the next one. It's all right. Next pitch comes, just nails her in the shoulder. And she drops the bat and buckles, and she's about to cry. And before I can help myself, my dad just leaps right out of my mouth, and I yell, "Suck it up and take your base." Everyone in the stands does this. Then I go, I love you. Are you okay? Then she's cracking up now. She's running to first base, and they nominated me for Mother of the Year. The point is, if we don't deal with our history, we are bound to repeat patterns. We see this in lots of ways. A man who swore he would not be angry like his father chooses to live his life emotionally unavailable so that he can't ever be close enough to someone to be triggered. But we all know that's not going to last very long. And when the tensions get too high living in a family, he explodes, says things his father says, acts like his father acts, and then he's ashamed. And he goes back to that, his walled up place, and swears, "I will never do that again. I do not want to be like my father." And on and on the cycle goes. Someone marries an alcoholic, divorces them, doesn't process that life, just says, "I am never going to do that again," gets remarried, marries a different kind of addict, lives in another codependent, unhealthy relationship. A survivor of sexual abuse becomes sexually promiscuous in order to gain control and power over that thing that controlled and overpowered her. If we don't deal with reality, reality will deal with us. Think of King David. If you don't know the story of King David, I'm going to give it to you like really fast. You should go home and read it. It's a fascinating story. The first time we meet King David is when the prophet of God comes to King David's family and says to his father, "I need to talk to all of your sons." David's father gathers all of the sons except David. Just leaves him out in the pasture. It doesn't even cross his mind that he has another son. After hours, the prophet says, "Are you sure you don't have any more children?" And the guy's like, "Oh yeah, there's David." So you can tell, he was treated like a nobody, like dirt. He didn't really count for much in his family. He was just David. God makes him king. David serves the Lord very well in a lot of ways, but there are a lot of other things he did that were very wrong, that he repeats patterns of his history. He becomes king. He gets filled with power. He sees a woman. He lusts after her. He decides he gets to have her because he's the king, brings her into the palace, has sex with her, finds out she's married, decides to kill her husband so that he can be in the clear. Fast forward years later. David has a bunch of children, all from different wives. We'll talk about that another time. All from different wives. He has one son named Amnon who lusts after his half-sister Tamar. Decides he gets to have what he wants. Tries to coerce Tamar. She'll have nothing to do with it, so he rapes her. Because he gets to have what he wants. Tamar's full brother hears of it, is enraged, goes to David, tells David of it. You know what David does? Nothing, absolutely nothing. Buries his head, can't value Tamar for anything. So you know what Absalom does? He kills his brother. Do you see it? Do you see the patterns? People treated like nothing. I get to have what I want when I want it. Hatred, murder, it's all right there. Because of the patterns of our history get repeated if they don't get processed. The Bible calls that generational sin. In psychology, we call it recapitulation. You're trying to rework something to get a different outcome. You're trying to gain mastery over the very thing that is master over you. But when you do it without Jesus, you're essentially just putting things around that container to try to hide it. takes courage to face our wounds, because sometimes what's inside when we take that lid off terrifies us. But listen to what the Lord says in Isaiah. Do not be afraid. I have called you by name, and you are mine. When you pass through the waters, they will not overtake you. And when you walk through the flame, you will not be destroyed. For I am the Lord your God. He says to you, I'm not saying the waters aren't scary. I'm not saying you won't feel like the waters are up to here and you feel like you're about to drown. But I am saying to you, I've got it. Because I know you by name. And you belong to me. Are those flames going to be hot? Is it going to terrify you when you take the lid off of that thing? Absolutely. But guess what? You will not be burned because I have called you. I have redeemed you. And I know your name. Every time Jesus healed someone, they had a part to play. If you think about it, he heals the lepers in Mark 1, and then he says, go cleanse yourself and show yourself to the priest. He heals a blind man by spitting in some dirt, putting some mud on his eyes, and saying, go wash in the lake. In Mark 6, he raises a dead girl to life and says to her mom, well, fix her something to eat, and tells the girl she needs to eat too. The woman who's caught in adultery, Jesus sends away her accusers, lifts her up and says to her, go and sin no more. You see, Jesus is the author of our healing. Jesus is the source of our healing. But living in that healing, that requires my cooperation. Living in that healing requires my cooperation. And when we don't deal, when we bury things alive, bad stuff grows. Darkness gains power. Those containers of old junk shoved somewhere in a corner of our lives, they become toxic waste inside of us. And toxic waste, you can fool yourself to think you're keeping it inside, but it has fumes. And it leaks out to the people that you love, like that paint spill. So the question is, are the wounds of your soul, is the pain of your past, is even your present circumstance being regularly brought into the light of God's grace? Because while your past can't be changed, it can absolutely be redeemed. Along with processing our wounds, we need to employ the power of gratitude. Gratitude is a powerful force. It is a game changer, my friends. It doesn't extricate us from the valley of the shadow of death, but it certainly changes the terrain. In Luke 17, Jesus is going through a village and he encounters 10 lepers who want to be healed. They beg him for mercy. And he says, go show yourself to the priest. You're healed. All 10 lepers are healed. Go to the priest. Only one returns. One returns to say thank you. Do you know what Jesus says to him? Rise and go your way. Your faith has made you well. Well, I thought he already healed them. Mm-hmm. He did. He sent all 10 of them away. All 10 of them no longer have leprosy. But only one of them is well. Only one of them found faith. Because Jesus received his gratitude as an act of faith and said, that furthered your healing. Gratitude can further our healing as well. Because gratitude yields hope, and hope produces joy, both of which are necessary for us to heal. Hope is to the soul what oxygen is to the lungs. It says in Proverbs that when a heart doesn't have hope, that heart is sick. Because a heart without hope cannot have joy. And remember, peace, hope, and joy, those are hallmarks of God's kingdom. For me, gratitude has been a pathway through the valley of the shadow of death. When the stress and the grief were so much, gratitude became something that saved my life. When I put myself to the practice, to the discipline of gratitude, to the intentional recalling of the ways that God's love was faithful and steadfast, specifically for me and my kids, as well as just eternally who God is. You know what happened? My heart began to breathe. My heart began to breathe much more deeply. What it looked like for me was every morning I would wake up and I would ask God to make me brave. And every night I would go to bed and I would take out my journal and I would write down as many things as I could think of that I had to be thankful for, things that I could be grateful for. Sometimes it was things like, thank you that the dishwasher didn't break today. Sometimes it was, thank you that we laughed at dinner. A lot of times your names were in that list. Thank you for this person. Thank you for this person. And sometimes it was just, thank you that I know you're trustworthy. But I would list everything I could think of. I remember the first Thanksgiving after death came crashing into our lives, someone asking me, what are you thankful for? And without even thinking, I just responded, I'm thankful to be thankful. Because for so long, grief had suffocated me that my thankfulness was simply a discipline. But as I practiced it, it reemerged as a primary experience of my life. And when it did, it brought with it hope and it brought with it joy. And so gratitude was an absolute necessity for me. Our hearts are enlarged by gratitude, our perspectives are changed, and we become way more aware of the mercies that God offers to us every single day. Gratitude does not deny the vacancies left by loss or the pain and suffering that's a reality in our lives, but it sort of provides like a counterbalance to it, you know? It illuminates the goodness and grace that coexists with my pain and suffering. And it also raises my gaze to look up and beyond those black clouds that are in the sky, knowing that there's a future where there's no pain and no suffering. Without gratitude, we'll be tempted to close off our hearts, to choose self-pity, fear, and bitterness in order to, in vain, try to protect ourselves from the pain. But if we want our hearts to remain permeable, if we want our hearts to remain open and come out through the valley of the shadow of death more alive, then we must choose gratitude as a companion. That's why it says in Philippians 4:6, rejoice in the Lord always. In everything, by prayer, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. We can choose our own walls of self-protection if we want. Or we can let the peace of God guard our hearts. Gratitude chooses God's protection. And Jesus sees it and receives it as an act of faith. Lastly, we must experience forgiveness. We must give it and we must receive it. Forgiveness is imperative for healing, but it is not easy. Not when there is deep pain. Oh, it's easy enough to forgive when someone frustrates you or says something kind of mean. You know, we all screw up. But those deep places of pain where someone has really betrayed you, someone has wronged you, someone has really hurt you, man, forgiveness is not easy. There has to be an answer to my desire for justice. My pain has to matter and count to someone. I think that's why people love the idea of karma. That my pain is floating out there somewhere in the cosmos, just waiting for the right moment to come and take you out. But forgiveness says, I'm going to let God run the universe. I'm going to let him choose where and how to dispense his justice and his judgment. And true forgiveness never, ever diminishes the pain of the wound. It's the antithesis, actually. True forgiveness fully faces the devastation brought on by that person's sin. It means that I absorb the pain and I release you from it, even though you don't deserve it. You see, forgiveness is costly. It means I live with the hurt that you created and I don't get to give it back to you. That's why I think forgiveness is kind of a crazy idea. It's kind of a crazy notion. Really, why should we forgive someone who's hurt us? Why should we forgive someone who's completely damaged our hearts, made us fearful, made us bleed, inflicted wounds. Why should we do that? Well, common teaching in the church, as well as out in secular community and psychology, is you should do that so that you're not bitter. You should forgive so that you're not encumbered by the weight of your anger. And I go, well, maybe. But in the deepest places of my wounding, if I weigh those two things, if I weigh the cost of forgiveness to me and the consequences of maybe maintaining a little bit of bitterness to protect myself, I don't know. Sometimes I might choose bitterness because it feels way less vulnerable. It feels way less like I could just be hurt again. It feels like somehow my pain is going to matter. It didn't just go away. Yeah, I just don't find that a compelling enough reason to forgive. I think it's a result of forgiveness. I think it's an awesome result, but I don't know that it's compelling enough for someone who's been abused to forgive their abuser. For someone who's been betrayed to forgive the betrayer. I can only find one reason, one sound, cogent reason that I ought to forgive someone. That's because Jesus forgave me. Without that, I choose bitterness every day. But Jesus forgave me first. So while I might want the world to run on, you know, the idea of fairness when it comes to you, like I think you should get what you deserve when you hurt me, the reality is I don't really want what I deserve. So when I realize that without God's mercy, I'd be up a creek. When I realize without God's mercy, I would be desperate and lost. Then I can choose to forgive you for the sin that you've committed against me. Not because you deserve it, but because I didn't deserve it, and Jesus gave it to me anyway. I remember sitting with a client as a marriage family therapist who was struggling with, she had been sexually abused by a member in her family. And we'd been working through the memories and the process. And in this particular session, she was just struggling with the injustice of it all. I remember her sitting there and just so stressed, saying, so he just gets away with it and I'm the only one who has to pay the price? And the Holy Spirit urged me to just lean forward and take her hand and say, someone else did pay the price. Someone was beaten to a pulp for that terrible thing done to you. Someone was rejected and scorned, treated like trash by his community because of that terrible thing done. Someone died and took on God's wrath for that terrible thing done to you. She just started crying. And as we sat there, I said, I guess the question before us is good enough that Jesus didn't just die for my sin? He died for those who sinned against me as well. It was a turning point for her to really connect with God and to receive his forgiveness and to give his forgiveness. We can claim the justice of the cross, my friends, and then we will be free to live in the mercy of it. That's real forgiveness. Jesus, at ultimate cost to himself, paid for my sin. He bore up under the consequences of the choices that I would make, the nature that lives within me. He took on the judgment and he took on God's wrath, the wrath that I deserved. He took it on in my place so he could offer me forgiveness. That is the only reason deep enough, wide enough, long enough, high enough, strong enough for me to forgive. My healing is possible because his wounds came from my sin. he suffered that I might be healed. And so I have no place to stand to not offer that same kind of mercy and forgiveness to another. It's also the only really compelling reason to receive forgiveness. Because maybe you're sitting here thinking, you know what, Heidi, I'm usually the offender, not the offended. And I'm so bound in shame, I can't even imagine being forgiven. I don't want to be released off the hook. I want to punish myself until the cows come home. I want to say to you today, Jesus died for your sin in the same way that he died for the people that you wounded. You are not outside of God's mercy. You are not outside of his reach. And when you say you're going to refuse his forgiveness, you say his death on the cross means nothing. Some people say, well, you know God forgives me, but I just can't forgive myself. Oh, let's think about that for a second. What are we saying when we say that? My opinions, my thoughts, my rules, my judgments, they're all way more important than God's. Because listen, people, if God has forgiven you, period, end of sentence, that's it, game over, bottom line. And if you say, I can't forgive myself, even though God forgives me, actually, you've got yourself in the place of God and God in your place. Forgiveness is real, and it's available to each one of us, and it's the only compelling reason I can find for us to extend that same forgiveness to one another. We have to engage the process. We got to pull out those containers, my friends. We got to open the lids. We got to know that Jesus is going to walk with us and hear him say, "Do not be afraid." We have to practice gratitude until it just becomes the way we live, where we just have eyes to see all the goodness of God in everything, and we need to forgive. And I want to remind you where we started today. We started with nothing is wasted. No matter how deep your pain, no matter how deep your shame, when that is brought to Jesus, nothing is wasted. We started with the words that began his ministry where he talked about healing and liberty and freedom and sight. And I want us to end with some of the last words that we have recorded from him in Revelation 21. And it says, "Behold, I am making all things new." That's the promise today. And it's a promise from the heart of Jesus. So wherever you are, whatever it is that's going on in your head, whatever wound has been picked, whatever fear you have going on, listen to Jesus say to you today, listen, nothing is wasted. Because I am making everything new. And healing and freedom and joy and hope, they can be yours. If you'll just let me go to those deep places with you. That's a promise I'm going to hold on to. That God is making everything new, even me, even you. Will you pray with me?